Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to learn how one mom's agonizing journey to diagnose Lyme disease in her teenage daughter has grown into one of the region's newest nonprofits, Partner in Lyme. We'll learn how this organization is helping folks meet the financial burden that Lyme disease can bring and how you can help at their first virtual fundraiser in early January. Then we're going to get some sobering news and maybe a little spark of hope as we replay our late September chat with a representative from the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis. We're going to hear the latest on jobs and household income growth, how they're being impacted by the COVID pandemic, and how legalized cannabis could go far toward propelling Connecticut out of the sorry economic state we find ourselves in right now. Then we're going to close replaying a conversation with the new Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion and the Chief Diversity Officer at the University of New Haven. We'll meet Dr. Lorenzo Boyd, who also heads up the UNH Center for Advanced Policing and is a nationally recognized authority on community policing and racial justice. And we'll discuss police practices, movements to defund police agencies, and identify that all-important crossover point where racial justice comes into play. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. The Connecticut Department of Social Services is offering free identity theft protection services to about 37,000 clients after investigating a possible data breach involving private health information. DSS officials stress that no actual disclosure of personal information was confirmed through extensive forensic reviews, but that identity theft protection services are being offered as a precautionary measure. The DSS is sending letters to potentially affected clients, former clients, and authorized representatives explaining the situation and offering free identity theft protection services. If you want to find out if you're an identity theft victim, visit the State Consumer Protection Agency at ct.gov/DCP. Our program is always so happy to make the acquaintance of folks who have a passion that turns into a cause. And our latest friend here on the award-winning For the People family is Jessica Snyder. She is the executive director of the newly formed Partner in Lyme Incorporated. PartnerInLyme.org is their website if you'd like to get to know more about their work. And I guess while we're sort of coming off a few days of wonderful weather, more spring and early summer like than the middle of November, Jessica, the issue is that a lot of people were probably taking the opportunity to get out, finish up buttoning down their yards, maybe going out for a hike, getting the kids out into the fresh air, going out to the parks or the ball fields. And we have been hearing about how this year, because of the weather that we had last winter, has been so bad for ticks. We're continuing to hear about new tick species that are coming into Connecticut that are bringing not only Lyme, but a host of other tick-borne diseases that either couple with or duplicate symptoms of Lyme, but are even much worse. And I know that probably is something that that keeps folks like you up at night, right?
It certainly has. This time of year is actually when the ticks are at their most active, and people tend to think that it's in the early summer months that you have to be most vigilant about protecting yourself and your family, but it's actually in the fall, and we haven't had the deep freezes of the past few winters, so the tick population has just multiplied exponentially year by year. Mm-hmm. And with the leaves and the yard work that you mentioned, we are coming into exposure with ticks and all the tick-borne illnesses that they carry. And it always, you know, makes me cringe when I see everyone's fall family pictures on Instagram where their children are just covered in leaf piles, because that's where ticks like to go and hide and lay their eggs and build their nests. And it's really very dangerous to have those types of exposures for our young children. It can set them up for many, many years, if not a lifetime of illness.
Yeah,
so,
another thing that people did going back to the sort of the early days of the pandemic, where we all started spending a lot more time at home and having a lot more free time, was a lot of folks who said, one of these days we're going to get a puppy or a kitten, or we're going to adopt an adult dog. They have gone out and done that, and those animals have also been out frolicking in the yard and in those leaves, and so they're bringing ticks back into the house, even if the folks who own those dogs are trying to be as careful themselves to try to avoid areas where ticks may be, or avoid having the kids play out there. This proliferation of ticks, in all likelihood some infected with Lyme and ready to pass it on, are coming right into the house.
Absolutely. They bring it right in, and you don't have to be, in wooded areas to have tick exposures. There's just as many cases of Lyme in pets and animals in the cities, because mice, squirrels, any type of rodent is a tick carrier, and those ticks drop and then they're picked up and brought right inside our homes, our apartments. It doesn't matter. We're not really safe anywhere from exposure to tick-borne diseases.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and living right near downtown Waterbury, and having the deers come right into my yard eating the pears off my tree. Obviously, you have to be living in a cave to know that the deers aren't also another major carrier of ticks, and probably helping to spread them. So this is a really big issue, and I understand that your inspiration over starting this nonprofit Partner in Lyme initiative came from Lyme disease diagnosis in your daughter. Is that right?
It is correct. Yes, my daughter was diagnosed in 2018 with Lyme disease. After 10 doctors and about a year and a half of searching for what was wrong with her, we finally uncovered that it was Lyme disease and a few other co-infections that came along with Lyme. And she was 18 and should have been at the most active stage in her life. And it took a lot from her. It took her ability to be active. It took her ability to drive long distances. It took her ability to go to college full time. And so as a way of looking for a positive in this disease, I decided to set out and create a positive for other people. And we started the nonprofit to give $1,000 to Connecticut residents who are in treatment for Lyme disease, to help them use the money for anything that falls under the Lyme umbrella of health and wellness. So it can be used for anything that helps them heal in body, mind, and spirit.
And now you said something that echoes with so many people, and I do an inordinate amount of reporting on tick-borne diseases and Lyme disease, and I have to say, I may be being a little bit kind in the statistic, but like 5-6 out of 10 people, maybe even 7 out of 10 people, all kind of say the same thing you do, that they went from doctor to doctor to doctor, or from test to test to test, or back over and over and over again, trying to kind of figure out what was wrong. And then eventually, and typically after Lyme disease had kind of really embedded within to their loved one or themselves, finally the lights went on and the Lyme disease was diagnosed. That frustration is got to be something that drives you.
As a parent, it's heartbreaking to watch your child suffer and not understand how to help her or him, and to know what the cause of their suffering is. It's extremely frustrating. And Lyme has been called the great mimicker because it mimics so many other common illnesses and diseases. So my daughter's story was that her symptoms came on the same day she was snowboarding. She came home with what mimicked classic concussion symptoms. She had light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, difficulty concentrating, difficulty reading. And even though she never fell, and she snowboards with a helmet, it was really strange. So we figured she must have some type of concussion. So we went that route. and it never got better. Her migraines were almost daily. She really wasn't able to finish out her senior year without an incredible amount of assistance. And we just jumped from doctor to doctor, from, you know, spine surgeons to neurologists. We did acupuncture. We did massage therapy, chiropractic medicine. We went to, you name it, we went. We had all these blood work done. We had MRIs done, EKGs done, EEGs done. We looked at everything, but nothing was really popping up. So we went to a doctor that had never seen her before, wasn't familiar with anybody in my family, and we just presented her as a test case. Please find what's wrong with my daughter. And on a Quest panel, Lyme came up. It's really important for your listeners to know that when you are experiencing symptoms that just don't make sense and you have a Lyme test, most doctors, under the guidance of the CDC, consider 5 bands of Lyme testing to be a positive diagnosis. Grace's test only showed up with 2 out of 5 bands positive. So the doctor sent us on our way and said that she was fine. Her blood work didn't require any follow-up. I had a copy of that blood work, and it just didn't sit well with me. So I took it to our naturopathic doctor. We went line by line through that blood work, and there are special labs throughout the country that test only for tick-borne diseases. So we sent blood work off to be special tested for tick-borne diseases, and it turns, in fact, she was very sick with Lyme disease, with Bartonella, with Mycoplasma pneumonia, and she required a lot of assistance. And that was in April of 2018. And, you know, she's still in treatment. And for her, because it had reached a chronic or late stage, you know, we say that she's living with Lyme and that this is something that she's going to have to manage until her symptoms go into remission. And hopefully, you know, we pray that that will be in her near future.
And you, like many people, regardless of whether you have insurance or good insurance or not, I understand a lot of people have to take on testing and unique courses of investigation that basically the insurance company sees you coming and they're like, none of this qualifies. So you're on your own. Was that the case with you?
Exactly. It is the case with us and with most people that suffer from Lyme, because the CDC only recognizes acute stage Lyme disease. When you see the tick, you catch the bullseye rash. They will cover doctors to treat for 2 weeks of antibiotic treatment. And past that, they feel that any symptoms that remain are a syndrome and therefore not really covered under any insurance program. So what's happened is doctors will traditionally treat with 2 weeks of doxycycline, and then you're kind of on your own, which is very unfortunate. So the doctors that do treat for Lyme disease, they have to step outside that practice, and they don't take insurance, and everything has to be self-funded, and it can cost, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. I know of families who have gone into financial ruin trying to heal their children. They've had to take out mortgages, sell homes, work 2 and 3 jobs. Lyme doctors are incredibly expensive. There are doctors in our area that charge over $1,000 for the initial visit. And, you know, our own experience was that each visit, between the office visit, the herbs, the supplements, the medication, can run between $500 and $700 a visit. And for most people I know, that's really challenging to come up with that amount of money in a very quick time frame, because you know, don't plan for Lyme disease. You know, it takes you by surprise, and it's a sudden financial impact that is really, it's unimaginable. I'm working on a program right now. I'm calling it The Cost of Lyme, where I've asked people to send me pictures of themselves holding a piece of paper with what their out-of-pocket cost has been for their treatment. And the most I've received so far is $500,000. And the pictures that come to me that break my heart are the ones that have zero, because they cannot afford to start treatment.
Well, that's where Partner in Lyme comes in. And one of the other things that is really important to reinforce to folks that are listening about organizations like yours, Jessica, is that you're able to keep the overhead low, basically an employee base of maybe one. And therefore, when you create this gift fund to be able to help people underwrite as much as that one initial visit with that $1,000 gift, that $1,000 donation turns into that $1,000 gift. It's not like you're taking $200-$400 off the top and applying it toward administrative fees. You're a 100% turnaround charity.
That is true. I don't take a salary from this. I do this because it's a true labor of love. I feel like it's what I'm called to do right now. And I self-fund it. So when I get donations in from our supporters, that money is turned around very quickly, and it's rolled right out to the people that apply for assistance. Unlike some of the other foundations and nonprofits, we realize that $1,000 is not going to fund an entire course of treatment for Lyme disease, but our goal is to help people afford the incidental items, things like wheelchairs, quality juicers, essential oils, saunas, physical therapy, chiropractic medicine, things that normally would get pushed aside because the bulk of their income is going towards the doctors and the herbs and the supplements and the medications. You know, our nonprofit kind of falls into a little bit of a different space where that we don't seek applications just once a year. When we get applications in, as long as we have the funding, we immediately put it right back out to them. So within about a week of having a completed application, that awardee has a check in hand.
That's great. Well, I know I've probably talked to 1,000 people in the past 8 or 10 months who basically have all just been striving toward one goal, and that is to get to 2021. And when we all get there, one of the first things that folks might be able to do if they've heard something that's inspiring or relatable to them is to help you put that supplemental money into the hands of folks who might not otherwise be able to even begin getting the therapy that their loved one needs to begin to deal with Lyme disease that they have. You've got a event coming up on January 23rd, 2021. What's that all about?
It is called Art with Heart. What we're doing is we are creating an online auction space for art to be auctioned to people in our community. And because it's online, it reaches beyond our community. We are seeking donations from artists, from local businesses that work in the health and wellness industry. And I'm really building a curated space of beautiful artwork, handmade items, goods and services that people can bid on and bring into their homes to either or in offices to enjoy or just to work on their own personal health and wellness. And that's going to be instrumental in funding our second year. Our goal for year one was to assist 10 individuals, and we were able to fund our first year without a major donor drive or fundraiser because we had to rethink everything in the age of COVID. So I took some time to really thoughtfully think that through, and we came up with a great system to do it online where it can be done safely, but also really incorporating the whole community. So whether you're an artist or you're a business person or you know someone in your family that has Lyme or you suffer from Lyme yourself, there's something there that will be in a price point that you can, you know, enjoy, and that money will go to fund our second year.
Excellent. There's also some fashions available. You've got some T-shirts available for $25 plus $5 for shipping outside of Fairfield County. Folks can look at them and order those shirts through your website. They can also learn about the Front Steps Project, which also helped infuse a good amount of cash into the system there for a Partner in Lyme. They can go to your Instagram or Facebook page and follow you and your organization there, or just to the website partnerinlyme.org. Our guest today has been Jessica Snyder. She is executive director of one of the Western Connecticut's newest 501c3 nonprofits. It's called Partner in Lyme. Partnerinlyme.org, once again, is their website. Go learn about them. If you know someone with Lyme disease, or if you have a loved one, or you yourself has Lyme disease, and you need a little bit of help to make ends meet and get what you need to get better, they may be the answer for you. So, Jessica, thank you so much for your time this morning. Congratulations on establishing this new cause and the great work that you're doing, and we look forward to talking with you again soon. Well, the voice on the other end of the line this morning for this segment is one that I have missed on the award-winning For the People. Fred Carstensen was a staple resource here on our program for so many years, and we're so excited after several years of missing him that he is back on the air with us. He is the director of the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis, and he's a professor at the UConn School of Business. And today we're going to really be concentrating on two very different aspects of employment and economics here in Connecticut. Fred has been great in forwarding me breaking economic information, and in the past 48 hours, we've got some very, very disturbing news from the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis, as well as the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So, Fred, we got a lot to talk about. Let's jump into these two back-to-back federal reports, and let's start it with the BLS, because you contacted me yesterday indicating sort of a disparity between what the federal government was reporting from the top down and what Connecticut is reporting from the bottom up. What's the story on that?
Well, the BLS, every Thursday morning at 8:30, releases a report on how many initial filings for unemployment have occurred across the nation as of a week ago. And it includes then a lot of additional information on total unemployment, how many people are actually receiving unemployment benefits right now. And it's really striking. You have to start, first of all, by understanding that the jobs report, the official jobs report, comes out once a month on the first Friday of each month, is designed to minimize the number of people that are considered unemployed. The last official jobs report said that the national unemployment was 8.4. Now, that's what's called U3. It's the third statistical measure. Mm-hmm. And it's designed in a way that will, as they say, minimize the number of people who are counted as unemployed. And this goes literally back 100 years, mm-hmm. Because politically, folks have not wanted to admit how bad things are. There is an additional measure in that monthly report that is the U6. You can always go and look, and anybody out there who's listening can go and get the BLS jobs report. At U6 is the broadest measure that they provide. Mm-hmm. And for August, the U6 was over 14%. Mm-hmm. So, and then if you look at how it's been going, the official number, the 8.4, has been going down faster than the U6, which tells you that things are probably not nearly as good nationally. Now, this morning, the report actually has the number that should be reported in October for September, mm-hmm. because the official jobs report, that monthly report, is always based on the week that includes the 12th of the month. Well, this morning's report actually includes the week of September 12th, and it says the national unemployment rate is 8.4%. In other words, it hasn't changed anything from what it was. Moreover, on initial filings, it says there's still about 860,000 new filings. So that's about where it was last week. This is a very narrow measure because this does not include gig workers and independent contractors. Mm-hmm. So that report says there's no improvement. A week ago, Connecticut was actually also on state level had the high, was sixth highest unemployment in the nation at 11.7%. Now, our State Department of Labor was reporting it was 8.1, but they're using a measure which, as I say, minimizes it. According to the official data, in fact, our unemployment rate was much higher. And this week, you know, it's very nice to see Connecticut fell off the list of the seven, eight worst states in the country. We're still probably are up pretty high. It's got a lot of small data in there. But nationally, things don't look good. If you look at the bigger number, how many people in the country right now are receiving unemployment benefits? Now, that includes people who are covered by the normal unemployment benefits framework, which only covers people who are on payroll. It excludes a tremendous share of the economy. Under the Relief Act, we permitted gig workers and independent contractors who've lost employment also to file for benefits. Well, as of a week ago, which is the most current data we have, 26 plus million are receiving benefits. That itself, just that number, implies an unemployment rate of roughly 16%. So nationally and in the state of Connecticut, things are looking as if at best we're flatlining. We may actually have started to go backward. And October 1st, there will be literally tens of thousands of additional layoffs or possibly furloughs, because the airlines will no longer be under the federal restriction. They got, you know, billions of dollars to keep their people on. And that runs out on October 1st. They've already announced that they're going to be laying off thousands of people. There are lots of other industries. There was just a news report recently that a survey of businesses said that they will not be bringing back the workers that they have furloughed. And they may, in fact, be laying off more workers.
So this I was going to say this near future occurrence is doubly concerning in relation to and as we speak, as we're recording this on September 24th, on Thursday around noontime, today there is you know, bad news from the Bureau of Economic Analysis
as well, because it specifically for Connecticut, because it released its estimates of household income for the second quarter, which is when we were in the pandemic. But we were also getting the $600 a week supplemental benefits, all of the other kind of interventions that did do a very good job of propping up the economy in the short run, but now have expired. And we haven't seen the full impact of that expiration. That's going to be coming down the pike in the next quarter in all likelihood. But yeah, people can no longer pay their rent. We're already seeing a lot of evictions, more and more bankruptcies. But in that report this morning from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, Connecticut is 49th. And I was talking to somebody earlier who called me about this, and I actually said, well, in a way, that's good news, because we're not 50th, because we are 50th as a state economy over the last 10 years. Our economy actually shrank between 2008, when we hit the peak, and February of 2020. Our economy was still, in inflation-adjusted real terms, the gross state product was about 6% smaller than it had been in 2008. We actually shrank as a state economy until 2016. And then we began almost 10%. And then we began a very, very modest recovery. So we're only down about, but no other, there's only one other state that's below full recovery. And our neighboring states, and this is really critical because a lot of this stuff is regional. How is it that Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York all fully recovered and got well past their previous peaks, both in employment and in output? And Connecticut sits there between three successful states, and we're like a black hole.
Well, what is what?
Who, very wrong.
Who has ventured a theory as to why that is?
Well, of course, it's Fred Carstensen, because that's my job. Well, first of all, let's preface this by, I want everybody who's listening to understand this. Between 1997 and 2007, Connecticut had the fastest growing economy probably in the nation on a per capita basis. National growth was about 24% over that period, but there was also population growth. So per capita was less than that. In Connecticut, we had almost no population growth, but we grew 33%. So we were going an awful lot faster. We were number one before 2008. Mm-hmm. After 2008, we become number 50. Mm-hmm. So something goes very wrong. And there, these things are never unicausal. It's lots of different things.
Sure.
You know, we'd let our infrastructure deteriorate. We had, you know, we hadn't done some of the things that we might have done, you know, at our universities. We weren't getting the same kind of commercialization, say, of intellectual property, though I'll say Yale has done a spectacular job. Mm-hmm. They've now got 50 companies that are spinoffs from Yale intellectual property, over $1 billion of investment.
Yeah.
UConn doesn't have a similar track record. It has not delivered on that front. And that's partly a product of internal policy. It's also a product of state policy and so on. But the big thing, I think, the single sort of single driver, remembering that this is only one of a number of, I mean, some is bad luck.
Some is
bad luck.
Somebody's got to be last.
Insurance industry that is, you know, being transformed by digital world.
Yep.
But the simple explanation, or the simplest explanation, is Connecticut somehow disconnected from the data-driven, digitally dependent modern economy. And how do we know that? We know that because when you look at occupations in Connecticut, it doesn't matter where people work,
mm-hmm.
but the nature of the occupation, if you look at the IT core occupations, which is the fastest growing occupational category nationally, and you look at Massachusetts and New York and Rhode Island, and they were all growing very strongly in this period. Connecticut had virtually no growth at all.
Hmm.
Rhode Island, my God, Rhode Island grew 10 times faster in IT-related occupations than Connecticut.
Hmm.
I have been told by an industry expert that there are high-speed fiber optic cables that go from Boston to New York without a single off-ramp in Connecticut.
Hmm.
So this is the vision. Think of I-95, I-84, and I-91 closing all of their interchanges in Connecticut and becoming through roads.
Yeah, pipelines between. Yep.
And no exit. And that's basically what appears to have happened to Connecticut.
Okay.
And so we end up focusing on tourism, hospitality, logistics.
Service industry stuff, yeah.
Service industries, which are low skill and low pay.
Great.
And that's where our job growth has been.
We always engage to the point where we can take up the whole hour because there's just so many factors related to what we talk about, Fred. I do want to take a break and come back and talk about this other study that your organization has just put out earlier this week or late last week. Fred Carstensen's with us. He's director of the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis and a professor at the UConn School of Business. We're going to be back to talk about cannabis and its possible future in really generating some green for the state of Connecticut right after this break. Stay with us. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Original artists and crafters are being sought to participate in Artists Sunday, an arts-focused shopping day the first Sunday after Thanksgiving, the largest shopping weekend of the year. The goal is simple, to help artists sell more of their work during the fall holiday season and to help shoppers find unique, personal, handmade gifts for their loved ones. You must be an original artist or craftsperson to participate as an artist, and that participation is free. If you'd like to learn more about sponsorship opportunities or to view the artists' frequently asked questions for all the details, just go to artists.com. Sunday.com. All right. Pleased to be back with an old and dear friend, Fred Carstensen. He is the director of the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis and a professor at UConn School of Business. CCEA has just released a study on cannabis legalization and its ties to creating strong job growth. And revenue and GDP, all the things that we have found has put Connecticut sort of at or just at the end of the line, economically speaking, in comparison with all our other states, and particularly with our neighboring states of New York, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, only one of which currently has a legal cannabis situation. And I guess Rhode Island, maybe if we were talking about who's next closest to make it happen, it is them. New York, it's still, I guess, a toss-up, Fred. Tell us a little bit about the CCEA study on cannabis legalization.
Well, we were asked by the Marijuana Policy Project several months ago to develop an analysis, a dynamic analysis that looks out over the first 5 years of retail sales. So it's 6 years in total because you have 1 year of startup for things, the state getting its regulatory framework in place for producers to develop the capacity to produce. And they asked us, would we look at what legalization would mean for the state of Connecticut in terms of job creation and in terms of state revenue and state GDP? And that's, we have a very, very special model of the state's economy that permits us to look at these kinds of effects over a long period of time. We've done, we did the analysis, for instance, for Vineyard Wind for the Yep. offshore 805 Yep. Kilowatt project. Mm-hmm. And we, for that, we actually did a 30-year Okay. projection on what it would mean. So we have a lot of experience looking at these specific issues and figuring out what it's going to mean for the state.
Yeah, well, in the last four or five minutes that we have with you, Fred, what are the high points of the study, if we may?
Give me the bottom line, and we modeled this looking very closely at what the experience of other states, but depending on how the state taxes this and depending on how it will spend the money that it comes in, we're looking at something between 10,000 net new permanent jobs and 17,000. It's a wide range because we don't know how the state's going to spend the money. Mm-hmm. And that's all very clear in the report. In aggregate, the state and municipalities, which get a 3% sales tax for locally, state in aggregate over the 6 years, it would add up to possibly $1 billion in new revenue for the state and mm-hmm. localities. And we believe that the study is actually quite conservative. We think the numbers could be substantially higher because the model that we're using actually is fairly optimistic about what would happen without this development. We think that it is more optimistic than it should be. We think a longer perspective, and we're actually going to come out with a 10-year forecast for the state's economy in a couple of weeks. We think that Connecticut, absent some very significant interventions, not just on this, but in other areas, is in for a very, very difficult period. And so this could figure in that 11 states have already made it recreational. More than 30 states have already approved medical marijuana, as has Connecticut. We already have medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. So this could really help us recover from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic shutdowns, and it could also help us restore that competitiveness that we lost in the period after 2008.
I found it intriguing that Jason Ortiz from the Minority Cannabis Business Association weighed in on this very favorably. In terms of the role that naysayers indicate that this would just be more of a detriment to our minority communities, there's actually an idea that legalized cannabis could actually be an economic driver for these communities.
Well, it would give them real employment. And, you know, the fact of the matter is cannabis is already here. We're already consuming it, you know, but we're consuming illegal, unregulated, potentially contaminated, with no oversight on its quality and its level of the drug.
Sure.
That it includes. And as Colorado has done, they have been very aggressive about policing the structure, making sure that it's non-contaminated, that the quality is what it is alleged to be. And they have dedicated part of that money that has come from the legalization of recreational marijuana to systematic medical studies. So we actually understand it. We think it's not as bad as alcohol and tobacco. Mm. Tobacco, of course, is particularly, but alcohol in excess. I mean, alcohol is ironic because in small quantities, we often think it seems to actually have some benefits. We don't know enough about cannabis in terms of detailed long-term studies. And one of the things that legalization has done, besides getting a regulatory framework that permits us to address these issues, and gets rid of a lot of the problems with, you know, an illegal substance, which is widely used, and it results in a lot of arrests and so on. And, of course, we've essentially backed away from that to a degree.
Yeah.
But it's a very confusing situation. Let's clarify the situation. Personally, and this isn't in the study, the purpose of the study was simply to report on job creation. But personally, I'm like, it's already here. We already have all the problems that people are complaining about. Legalization actually permits us to address them more coherently and more meaningfully, and it gives us the money to do so.
Yeah.
Right now, we're sort of in the worst possible. It's already being consumed. It's already widely available.
Yeah.
My understanding, I'm not a user. But my understanding, I know some people who are, and they tell me that it's very easy to get. I mean, it's here, folks.
Right.
So let's legalize it and bring it under the umbrella of oversight.
Right. So we're already over time.
Be honest about the issue.
Yeah, we're already over time, but there is one more important question I hope you can briefly just begin to address, and then hopefully we can circle back and talk more about this before the end of the year, Fred. And that is the negative, the red ink that we talked about in the first half of our conversation. Can that be either wiped out or substantially addressed by the potential $0.5 to $1 billion a year that Connecticut may see in legalized cannabis revenue in the next 3 years?
It would only mitigate it. We need several other very significant initiatives on the part of the state. We are extremely competitive if we have the right regulatory and tax structure to actually build hyperscale cloud $1 billion data centers,
yep,
which would drive a tremendous amount of economic growth and, yep, what we call co-location.
Yes.
Companies would be attracted here. There are several other initiatives that the state ought to be considering very seriously. If this is an urgent matter, and the legislature and the governor should carve out a period of time when they focus just on economic development, because we've got to change the trajectory that we're on. And the only way we're going to change it is if we get a variety of new state initiatives. They don't necessarily involve spending money.
Right.
They involve creating an appropriate framework to make us more competitive.
Very good. We got to leave it at that, Fred. But as always, never enough time and always incredibly compelling stuff, even for early on a Sunday morning. I hope a lot of people kind of hear it half asleep and then decide they're going to come back and check out the podcast to really dig a little bit more deeply into it. If you want to read the full report from CCEA on cannabis legalization and its potential to create strong growth in jobs, revenue, and GDP, go to MPP.org/CCEA. Our guest is the director of CCEA here in Connecticut, Fred Carstensen, a professor at UConn School of Business and a longtime friend and resource to the award-winning For the People. Fred, thank you so much. I'm so pleased to be opening the program this morning with a brand new friend, talking for a few moments before we got on the air. We have found we have a little bit of overlap on the left coast from many years ago, back in the 80s. But right now he's here and he's in New Haven. I'm talking about Dr. Lorenzo Boyd, who just around a little under a month ago was named Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion and Chief Diversity Officer at the University of New Haven. And we're really, really excited, but also offer you congratulations, Dr. Boyd, for your promotion. Although this isn't, you're not new to the University of New Haven system, right?
No, I've been here. First of all, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I've actually been here about 18 months. I came here as the director for the Center for Advanced Policing.
Very good. Well, this is something that has been on the minds of many, many people. The issue of police and their work with various racial groups has been a subject of concern and discussion and controversy for decades. But let's talk a little bit about what you're seeing today as we look across the landscape of Connecticut police organizations, and a little bit about, incorporating some of your history, including, at least a period of time in training as a police officer yourself before you moved on to other things.
Well, Connecticut is a little different. Typically, Northern police departments and Northeast police departments tend to be a little more progressive, but we can't paint all police departments in Connecticut with the same brush because there's so much divergence between the 129 cities and towns and all the different municipalities. But what I am seeing in Connecticut is that there's a level of professionalism in Connecticut that I appreciate. There have been police departments that I work for all over the country. I'm trying to get them to where some of these departments are in Connecticut. In particular, Yale University Police, I would view as the gold standard of policing, just based on their level of professionalism and their level of training. But there's also some really good things going on with Chief Riddick up in West Hartford, and Chief Reyes in New Haven is doing some really good things. So I'm impressed in general. And the state police have shown a lot of character with the protest that happened. So for the most part, I'm pretty pleased with the way policing is going on for the most part.
Yeah, I guess probably one of the biggest challenges that maybe you're seeing is the tendency to want to paint an entire department based on the actions of one individual or a few individuals. And certainly this has got to be some source of frustration for you because with the number of law enforcement professionals you work with and the many that I and we have heard from here on For the People, there is so much kind of shared regret, this sort of, one in a thousand and poisoning the whole barrel concept.
Yeah, I actually believe that numbers are a little higher than that, unfortunately. And I was doing a webinar for the city of New York a couple of months ago. And the premise is that the vast majority of police officers, I believe, are God-fearing, law-abiding people trying to do the right thing. And unfortunately, there's a percentage, maybe 10% that kind of go off the rails or go rogue and make it bad for everyone else. And when I was doing the webinar, an elderly citizen, a grandmother in New York from one of the boroughs, said, "Dr. Boyd, you keep saying there are all these good police officers, and where are these good officers when the bad officers are doing bad things?" And I had no answer to that. And then her follow-up was, if good officers aren't helping when bad officers do bad things, doesn't that then make them bad officers as well? So that's the question we're forced with, because it's really hard to have police officers police themselves. And to borrow the quote from Johnny Cochran in his final summation in the OJ trial, the rhetorical question, who polices the police? That's the question that we need, because it's really hard to expect good officers or normal officers or regular officers to start turning in the officers that are doing bad things. Most often people are saying, I see how he did it. Let's handle this internally, or let's handle this off the record. Mm-hmm. But bad officers, the few bad officers, if we're saying that there are just a few, we need to hold them accountable, and we need to make sure they stop being the police because they're wrecking it for the good men and women doing the job.
Yeah. Well, this also speaks to the greater movement in talking about a painting with a broad brush. Let's switch gears and talk a little bit about this defunding the police kind of catchphrase or movement, if you will. I guess it's kind of like social distancing. It's a phrase that's caught on, but really has significantly different implications, right?
Absolutely. And the thing about protests, and I teach a class called The Sociology of Social Movements. So I try to get into the groupthink and understand where people are going. And in order for a protest to work, there has to be a phrase that catches on, and it has to be almost a a quotable phrase, something small, and defund the police works. It's a soundbite. But ultimately, virtually no one thinks that we should take 100% of the money out of policing and have no police at all. I don't think that's the point that anyone is saying. What they are saying is something that happens all the time, and people are up in arms about it when we call it what it is, but every single year, the police chief and the mayor, or the police chief and the city manager, wrestle over funding. And in a year like this, where the state is taking in less taxes and or fewer taxes, and they give less money to municipalities, then mayors have less money to give. So the mayor's going to negotiate with the police about how much money you're going to get versus how much money we take away. So that happens all the time. But the paradigm shift is understanding nationally between 80 and 85% of a police budget, between 80 and 85% is salary and benefits. And of that 80 to 85%, about 20% of that is overtime. So the question is, what would happen if we take a portion of the overtime money and put it into programs that prevent the reason for needing overtime? Mm. So understanding that crime is not the problem. Crime is symptomatic of larger problems in society. Drug addiction, lack of education, unemployment, transiency, homelessness. So if we take some of the money from the overtime budget and put it into preventative programs to help bolster communities, then crime rates would go down, and then the police are left doing what the police are supposed to do, serve and protect. Because the problem is that upwards of 90% of policing is reactive. After a crime already happened, then the police spring into action. So what would happen if we go back and fix the reason that they do this? So, and going back to the West Coast analogy, the Los Angeles mayor, Eric Garcetti, took $250 million and turned it into youth programs and community programs. And of that $250 million, $125 million came out of the LAPD budget. And people said that that's going to decimate the department. But that's not so, because the LAPD budget annually is $1.8 billion. Mm. So taking $125 million is probably about 4% of their overtime budget. So it's not that much money. So when we talk defund the police, what we're also saying is let's reallocate resources to be proactive.
Very good. Well, we only have you for two or three more minutes, Dr. Boyd, but I'd like to close just overlapping the police issue with diversity. In your world, what are a couple of the most important things you'd like to leave people with in terms of an impression about policing and diversity?
One of the issues that we have is police officers and communities of color in particular tend to have a negative relationship, probably because they don't spend time getting to know each other. So at the Center for Advanced Policing, when we do training, we get police officers and community members together because we want the police officers to understand the lived experience of people that they're policing. But the flip side is we also need community members to understand the things that the police are going through. So the diversity issue is that predominantly white police officers are going into predominantly communities of color and the two not understanding each other. So if we can build that bridge to have community members and police officers together, it's kind of like the old community policing model. Mm. If we can get the community and the police to work together before crime happens, and the best police departments solve problems before they become crimes.
And a model New Haven kind of made famous, didn't it?
Absolutely. Actually, the New Haven Project Longevity was a version of what we did in Boston 2 or 3 years earlier, Operation Ceasefire. It worked there. It's working here. It's a model that works. So if we can get police departments to join community policing, not as a strategy, but community policing as a philosophy, then we can move forward and we can help.
Dr. Lorenzo Boyd, great to make your acquaintance and hope we can have another stimulating conversation soon as you begin your new job as Vice President for Diversity as well as Inclusion and Chief Diversity Officer at the University of New Haven. Dr. Boyd also serves as the Director of the Center for Advanced Policing at the University. Dr. Boyd, a great pleasure to speak with you, and we will circle back and talk to you again soon. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.